KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Listening to Trans Positive here on KBOO Community Radio. We are very honored to have a very special guest. We have Veronica Selver with us, and Veronica Selver was one of the filmmakers who helped to produce the landmark 1977 queer documentary called The Word Is Out, which was a film which explored the lives of 26 different individuals who were known or who had a story to share at the time in 1977 about being lesbian, gay, bisexual, etc. So, Veronica, welcome to Transpositive.
Well, thank you. Delighted to be here.
Thanks. Yeah, we're so excited to have you. So you helped, you had a role in the production of the film Word Is Out. Can you tell us a little bit about your role in that film?
Yes, of course. Word Is Out was made by six people. It was conceived by Peter Adair, who was just sort of parenthetically, Peter and I went to high school together in New York, and we were very, very close friends. In fact, I partially came out to California to be near him. And he conceived of this film because, as a gay man, in the early 70s, in the 70s, he felt that it was necessary for gay people to speak to each other, that it was really a time when it was perhaps possible to come out, and that the notion of support from other gay people was crucial. And he really designed the film idea, to have gay filmmakers, which is what we were, speak to gay subjects about their lives, about their lives as gay people in the United States. And he generated a group of us because he felt that he could not, by himself, although he was a cinematographer, he could not tap into the range of homosexuals that he wanted to include. For example, he began the film with his sister, who was also gay, Nancy Adair, and she was able to do interviews with lesbians in a lesbian bar. He didn't feel he could get that kind of response, that kind of intimacy and openness. So we each had a role to play, really, the six of us. We were three men and three women, and we were very congenial, I have to say. As I said, Peter was my dear, dear friend. I knew Nancy as family. We brought in, Peter initiated, and we brought in three more people. I was the third person in the film. There was Peter, and there was Nancy. And one of the things that the two of them did was pre-interviews. Everybody that we have in the film, which is 26 people, 25 people, speaking to camera about their lives as gay people, each one of them was pre-interviewed. And that's something we all did. We all did pre-interviews with the various subjects that we chose to speak with. And it's based on those pre-interviews that of which there were many. There were many. I was just reading this wonderful book called Word Is Out by Greg Eumanns. It was originally his PhD thesis. It became a book. But in any case, he reminded me of some things, one of them being that there were about 120 pre-interviews that we did to select the people that we did finally select to shoot on film. The pre-interviews were done on tape. And we all did some pre-interviews and watched our pre-interviews together to select the people. Am I speaking too much?
No, not at all. For me, looking back on this now, this is 47 years ago. I mean, I just can't imagine what it was like. I mean, at a time when there wasn't really a long history of queer cinema, queer documentary. I mean, there was some underground stuff. There were a couple of mainstream things. But, I mean, this was really a groundbreaking documentary film. What did it feel like to... I mean, did you realize that that's what it was when you started it?
Well, that's a really very good question. We started the film with... We're California-based. We're Bay Area-based. And Peter and Nancy, as I said, brother-sister, did the original pre-interviews. Based on those pre-interviews, which were all local, we went back, and by now we were five people. Lucy Massey Phoenix came in as the later person. We filmed the people who interested us from the gay community in the Bay Area. And we selected, I think it was eight people, and we filmed them. We filmed them in a very particular way, which is that the person doing the interview was also the cinematographer. And we were all learning this. Peter was the one person who really had experience, but he trusted us. He set up the camera, and we were behind the camera speaking to our subjects. And they were looking directly into the camera. So there was a kind of intimacy that was developed between the cinematographer and the subject. And we chose eight subjects that interested us, Bay Area based, and we cut them into a, what we call a rough cut. We cut them into a first pass at cutting the film. The structure of the film was intercutting the interviews. That is to say, one person would speak about, let's say, her early experience feeling gay. And we would cut from that to somebody else having the same kind of discovery. And so we intercut these people. And that was the structure of the film. That was the formal structure of the film, and that remained throughout the film. But the point here is that I was already a I guess I was already an editor. We were not all equally advanced in filmmaking. Rob Epstein, who became very, very productive and makes beautiful movies and has quite the reputation. He's had two Oscars already. I mean, but he was 19 at the time, and he came into the project out of curiosity and interest, but was not yet a filmmaker. Same thing with Andrew Brown. The filmmakers were Peter and me. We were both the two people who had filmic experience. I'd already been a sound editor and a visual editor. Peter had already made a beautiful film of his own called Holy Ghost People. In any case, Peter and I basically, we cut the film together that way, and we had a screening. We had a screening of this rough cut for the community, that is to say, the gay community. We invited a gay audience, primarily a gay audience, to come and watch this film in progress that we were making. And at the end of that screening, it became evident to us that the film was received as a representation of gay people. The audience was so hooked into the film, and they really were it was the audience in that early 1976 screening that made it clear to us that we had to expand our horizons, both geographically and from the point of view of who we were speaking with. Because we sort of intuitively chose our six or eight people because they interested us, not because they represented a purposeful diversity. It was after that screening for the community that we started to look for and to seek a purposeful diversity. We did that both, as I say, geographically and from the point of view of different perspectives. And the first thing we did is travel across the country. Four of us did that. And My job was to find professional women. That was my job, professional lesbians who were professional women, academics, and whatever professionalism meant. Rob Epstein had to go after college students. Andrew Brown, who is African-American, went after African-American subjects. Nancy Adair went after feminists and, yes, feminists specifically. Anyway, we then, as I say, then expanded the project. But initially, we didn't realize it would have that scope in influence, in its impact on gay people, and in its breadth. So we wound up with 25 or 26 interviews rather than the original 8 that we first chose.
Yeah, the film is just so, it has such an intuitive feel to it. It feels like you're sitting down and just having a conversation with your friends, you know, like you're at a coffee shop or a bar or at a really nice gathering, and you're just sitting down with a bunch of your friends and they're kind of just telling you their story. It's just, it's so well produced and it's so well constructed.
Well,
and the
gee,
way that the stories,
go ahead.
Yeah, the way that the stories are interwoven, it's beautiful. I mean, it's a beautiful piece of filmmaking, and it stands the test of time so well. I mean, I saw it just last month. That was the first time I'd seen it. I've been hearing about it for a few years now, but. And I just, I mean, it felt like my community, you know, it felt like the community I've known my whole life. And I just, I mean, I compliment you on making such an amazing piece of film 47 years ago when there wasn't much of a history of queer cinema at the time. I mean, you know, that was, your film came out a couple of years before, or no, maybe a couple of years after A Very Natural Thing, which was another... you know, that wasn't a documentary, that was more of a work of fiction, but it told the story of the lives of gay male culture in New York City around the mid-1970s, and kind of the choices that the characters in that film made, who kind of gravitated between Manhattan and Fire Island. And that was also a good film that kind of represented and caught its moment. And it seemed like there's just this optimism in your film that's just so, and it's so, it was so like farsighted. I mean, it was really looking into the future of what queer identity was going to unfold and become. I mean, you know, at the time we didn't have, there wasn't gay marriage. You know, there were no transgender people. We didn't have any rights. There's been so much progress in the last 47 years since this film was made. One of the things I've heard about the film is that it was attempting to just show queer people in that, you know, just as normal everyday people, just living their lives. Was that part of the intention of the film?
Well, let me just first of all say thank you so much for your really lovely, lovely review of the film. It's really, really touching to hear this. And just to finish on that, there was a genuine feeling of intimacy with the subjects that we interviewed. It just sort of evolved that way, and it really did have purposefully a kind of conversational point of view. One of the aspects of that is that we, as the interviewers, were able to engage. In other words, you would hear our voices too. Very often in filmmaking, the interviewer tries to be inaudible, not just invisible, but inaudible. In our case, it was, we were part of the, our part of the interviewing was in the film itself. You know, you heard us. So there was that, and I just wanted to thank you for your expression. Now, in the meantime, I've forgotten what your last question was, which is, what was our intention? I think that's what you're
that's correct. And
the intention was genuinely Peter's intention to begin with, fundamentally, was for gay people. In other words, it really was a film that was designed, that was meant for gay people, for us to be talking to each other, for us to reveal the kind of organic and natural flow of our own homosexualities that we all shared. I think that given that six of us were making the film, we each had a somewhat different orientation about what our expectations or our hopes might be. For example, did we care about what a straight audience might feel about this film, given that its primary incentive was gay people talking to each other? And for example, speaking for myself, it mattered very much to me what my mother would think about this film. My mother is a straight woman.
Yeah.
Was a straight woman. So, I mean, we all had maybe a particular person in mind, a kind of audience in mind. We, as I say, our intention was conversations with gay people, by gay people, but it did also include the notion that straight people might hear us also. And that was more or less important to the various six of us, if I may put it that way. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. At the time, how was the film received? I mean, you talked about the rough cut and how you realized after doing your rough cut that you needed to go out and expand geographically and also representationally. So after you did that, I mean, you obviously traveled around the country because the film is shot all over the place, New Mexico. It looks like some of it's maybe on the East Coast. You know,
yes.
You can tell some of it's in the Bay Area. So then of course you've got more diverse, I think, probably than what you're expressing that you had in your rough cut. So once you had a more like complete set of interviews, how was the film received? Tell me more about what happened next.
Sure. Okay. Well, the first thing I should say is that we had a number of rough cut screenings. In other words, it was extremely important to us how I call it the gay community around us responded to the film. And we did not do all of the second round of interviews at the same time. That is to say that we screened four audiences, primarily, as I say, gay audiences. We screened both in New York and in the Bay Area. And as we screened, certain let's say, missing perspectives were brought up. For example, I bring this up. We did not have an articulated feminist person in our film until we had Sally Gerhardt, who is now a well-known feminist personality. There's a whole film made about her that just came out, very lovely film called Sally. We we engaged the community to guide us. And we had community screenings, or rough cut screenings, I should say, that were very important to help us determine who needed to be in the film that wasn't there yet. So, as I say, we didn't just shoot everybody that in one fell swoop. We did, you know, for example, there's a lovely person in the film, Nick Dorsky. Nick Dorsky came in late. He was a close friend of Peter's from Antioch College. They were college friends. And Nick, in seeing the film, felt that there was nobody who really represented Peter, let's say, as a kind of... Nick is also a filmmaker. He's also a gay man. And so we engaged, as I say, the community to help us continue find people that were missing. Again, I don't know if that was your question.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I was just wondering, kind of how the film progressed from your first rough cut, and I guess you went through several rough cuts where you invited more people in. And then I assume at some point you had what was, you know, approximately a finished product. And
yes.
And then I assume you did you already have a company or some representation for getting the film out there? How did that go?
Well, Peter was the linchpin. I mean, he, again, not only conceived of the film, but he was the producer. We were all directors, but he was the producer, and his job was, as producer, to find funding, for one, and to sort of think ahead of where this might be shown, what its future might be as a film. He was connected to the local PBS station, KQED, here in the Bay Area, and he himself, did he have a company? He must have had a company. I mean, subsequently he had a company, Adair and Armstrong, but at the time of making the film, we must have had a 501c3 where people could contribute. For sure. I'm not quite as aware of that end of things, because Peter really took care of that.
Was the film originally screened for television, or was it screened for cinema?
It was screened. It had visibility in both venues. It was screened in cinemas before it was screened on TV. We came out theatrically in December 1977. We had a theatrical run in the Bay Area. We had a theatrical run, in New York. And it was screened on TV nationally in 1978. But we'd had a theatrical run before then. We had help, we had financial help, we had, you know, wonderfully committed people who funded publicity for the film. We had theatrical venues, again, that I think Peter organized, but there was a lot of support from the community, and that included financial support. So we were able to publicize the film. I remember in San Francisco, the buses had like a big "word is out," you know, publicity. I mean, so we had both venues. I don't think it was conceived for television. I think it was conceived theatrically, but Peter understood that there could be a theatrical a television run. And of course, the audiences for both were quite different. The impact of the television was enormous, just an enormous, unexpected, really, impact. First of all, people could see it in their homes. Second of all, it was a place where many more straight people saw it, parents, it had a much wider audience as a television. And I think a greater impact by just its greater visibility on TV, but it was not conceived for television.
Yeah. Did your mother see it?
Of course.
Tell me about that.
That's a great question. Oh, well, my mother, first of all, my mother, as I said, Peter was a very dear friend of mine in high school, and my mother knew Peter intimately. I mean, we were very close. So she was, she was very proud of us. She was very proud of us, very proud of all of us. And as a matter of fact, I should say that my mother had a summer house, and on the Cape, on Cape Cod, in the East Coast. And when the six of us looked at the pre-interviews that we had shot for the film, we did an intense 2 weeks doing nothing but looking at pre-interviews at my mother's house. So she already totally welcomed the project and supported it early on. And so I think for all of us, I must say, for all of us, our parents were extremely supportive. We, first of all, obviously the Adair parents were extremely supportive. Casey Adair, who was the mother of Peter and Nancy. Nancy and Casey wrote a book together. They put out a book of Word Is Out with the full interviews in the book. Our parental group was marvelous. And we were very fortunate that way.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. There were so many stories of people whose parents rejected them. And we just didn't have that at all.
Yeah.
Fortunate.
So the film, it covers the stories of 26 people, but it does it. You produce the film in a way that is, it's really interesting because you don't necessarily elevate people who were prominent at the time by embellishing their stories or making their prominence a really visible part. I mean, like, each interview is just that individual talking to who's ever behind the camera, and like whatever cues you get, you just kind of have to pick up on. Like, for instance, one that I think a lot of viewers might be familiar with is Harry Hay, who was the founder of the Mattachine Society and also the Radical Fairies. And Harry Hay isn't really presented as, anything other than a person telling his story and talking about the kind of questions that you asked him. Can you tell me a little bit about those choices that you made, like with people like Harry Hay or Sally Gearhart, or there were a couple of other people in there who I think were probably really well known at the time?
To respond to that, you single out Harry Hay and Sally Gearhart, indeed, who was a latecomer in the project. As I mentioned, she represented something we didn't feel we had, which was a really articulate feminist perspective, a feminist lesbian perspective, let me put it that way. And she was known at the time. She was known. I think that we purposefully did not celebrate, if I may put it that way, prominent people. And as a matter of fact, I think we avoided, if I can say, I think without it's actually having been discussed among us, I think we avoided really prominent people because we felt that that would sort of draw the attention. You know, we would be geared toward the well-known people, and less, there would be less sense of sort of the equality of all of the experiences in the film. I want to bring up something here. We were six people making the film, and you know, that's complicated. That's a complicated set of six directors, so to speak. We had a system that was devised by Nancy Adair called Pass the Rattle. This is what we called it. And we met regularly. We met, you know, we were always working, we were cutting, but we met regularly in the office, and we each had a chance to speak. That was called Pass the Rattle, speak without being interrupted. So we really heard each other, and we really helped each other define what mattered to us as we went along. And you know, the men and the women had sort of different experiences of their own homosexuality. It was a time, because it was, of course, pre-AIDS, it was a time when men had the opportunity to go to baths and to have sexual experiences that we, as women, didn't have the same outlets, if you want, and our sexuality was different in any case. Mm-hmm. But we were pretty open with each other about how to balance the male experience with the female experience. And this is something that we did talk about together. I wonder, as a viewer of the film, if that, how that balance appeared to you.
Oh, yeah, it definitely came out. I mean, I really think about it, especially in the interviews with the, I mean, they were conducted both separately and together with the two women from New Mexico who were lesbians, and they lived. I'm not sure. I spent a lot of time in New Mexico, so I kind of recognize where they were. I think they were like somewhere in
Corrales.
Like Albuquerque.
Corrales, exactly.
Right? Yeah. You know, they were talking about like how they experience sexuality, what they wanted from each other, you know, really very clearly about how they, one of them especially, spend a lot of time talking about like not wanting to experience the male gaze, and you know, just having a different kind of understanding of, and I felt like that was one example of where it was really clear how people were, you know, helping to define how they experience and define their sexuality, which was just, I mean, it's just one of the many interviews. There were so many. I mean, it's such a great film. Let me just do a promo here really quick. We're talking right now with Veronica Selver, who is one of the filmmakers of the landmark 1977 film, Word Is Out, which was one of the first documentaries about lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender folks to really go mainstream. I mean, like where it had a mass audience on PBS, where people really got to hear about the lives of ordinary gays and lesbians. And so we're just really, the film premiered 47 years ago, and Veronica's just talking with us today here on Transpositive, here on KBOO, about the film and some of the goings on around the film. So Veronica, what about some of the characters in the film? Have you had a chance over the years to track them? Do you keep up
Yes.
with people who are in the I know some of them have passed.
Yes, of course, some of them have passed. Peter, yeah, some of them have passed. They're, of course, from AIDS. We lost of Michael Mintz died, Donald Hackett died, George Mendenhall died, but not of AIDS. And of course, some of them have died. They were older. Peter died of AIDS in 1996. It was a great loss for me and for all of us. But when we had a DVD come out, and the DVD was a celebration of the 30th anniversary of the film. It seems like it doesn't seem like it was that long ago, but it was. And at the time of the coming out of the DVD, we went back and did updates on the people. So we did updates on the people 30 years after they showed up in the film. And these updates are part of the DVD. We were able to track the people that were alive, as I say, 30 years after the film, a number of them had died. The only people who were alive and did not want to be re-interviewed, I should say, were Whitey. Whitey was one of our wonderful, wonderful characters who is early on in the film, tells us, she's sort of in the early part of the film, tells us how difficult it was for her to be a lesbian at the time that she was growing up. And she was, in fact, institutionalized. And of course, she came out of that. But she's someone who was deeply marked by the difficulty that she had in piercing through the homophobia that she experienced, both at home and in the world. So she was somebody who did not want to go through again talking about herself. She did it in the film. She did it heroically and beautifully in the film, but she was not interested in participating in an update. And the only other person who didn't want to was a Southern person, Linda Marco, very lovely, beautiful young woman who, after the film and in her life experience, got married to a man, and I think she was shy of revisiting those years. But we talked with others 30 years later, and it was a kind of wonderful reunion for us. We spoke with any number of the people who are still alive, and we caught up with them. And I don't know if you want to know specifics, but on the whole, the experience of being in the film was a very positive one for all the
Oh,
people
yeah.
we re-interviewed, except, as I say, Linda Marco, who didn't really want to be re-interviewed, and Whitey, who chose not to be re-interviewed either.
Yeah, I
But
can imagine. One of the characters in the film was I can remember, I think, was he running for San Francisco City Commissioner the same
Rick
year
Stokes,
Harvey Milk was? Yeah. And
yes,
he
Rick
just passed
Stokes.
away recently, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah.
Very recently. He was a big deal in San Francisco. He was the owner of some of the baths. Or one of the baths. In any case, he was well known in the gay community as a leader. Harvey Milk won over him in the election, but he ran against Harvey. So
did he ever get elected in the future? Did he run again after that?
You know,
year,
Emma, 19... I don't know the answer to that. Oh, yeah. I stayed in touch with him, but I don't. I'm not sure. I don't know.
Yeah. Who did you interview? Did you interview any of the people
First of all, we didn't always just interview one person. For example, I picked up an interview that Nancy began with Elsa Gitlow. The oldest person in our film. She was 78 at the time that she was interviewed. She was the oldest. And I picked up the interview at a certain point and continued and finished it with Elsa Gitlow. I interviewed Betty Powell, who was the African-American woman in the film. I interviewed the two women who were the New Mexico couple. Nadine and Rosa.
Oh my gosh, those were so great. Yeah.
they became friends. We stayed in touch. Went back to see them. I mean, just wonderful, wonderful people. Yeah. They did break up, alas, which was very painful for Nadine. Let's see. I interviewed Dennis Chu, who was the Asian person in the film.
Yeah.
I interviewed Nick Dorsky, who was the latecomer in the film, who was Peter's classmate at Antioch. I mean, when I say I interviewed, I mean, I think Dennis Chu, Rob interviewed, we picked up, we co-interviewed various people. I don't know if I'm forgetting some of the people that I...
Did you interview, I can't remember, who was the, was she a professor in the Bay Area? And then later on, I think she was up in Wairika.
That's Sally Gerhart? Sally Gerhart was interviewed by Lucy Massey Phoenix, in large part, and I think partially by Nancy Adair. But that was really, Lucy's interview, and she did a fabulous job, I think.
She did, yeah, she was great.
It's just great. And I mentioned early on, but I mention again that there now is a full feature film on feature documentary on Sally, which is quite wonderful, and it's out now, it's in festivals, it's just having its run. And a lot of Lucy's interview from Word Is Out is in that Sally film. And the interesting thing I should point out, that we also interviewed by affinities, that is to say, it isn't just that some of us were geographically placed to interview. I initially interviewed Nadine and Rosa, so I went back to interview them. I've continued the interview with Elsa Gitlow, the 78-year-old person, because we had a kind of affinity for each other, let me put it that way. Mm-hmm. And I believe that Lucy had a very good sense of the trajectory of Sally Gerhart. Partially, they're both Southern, and there was just an understanding between them, and I think that brought out a really excellent interview. Stronger than I might have been able to do with Sally, as much as I love Sally. My orientation might have been different. Things fell into place in that way. Peter and Nancy both interviewed Pat Bond, who's a terrific interview in the film. She's She was in the military during World War II. She was part of a woman's contingent in World War II. Talked about gay life, and you know she's a wonderful.
Oh, I know, that was so moving. Yeah, she talked about what happens when you get outed in the military,
right?
before Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Yeah.
One thing about her, I just want to mention that because is that a consequence of being in Word Is Out and really being so successful, I mean, people really loved her. She designed her own one-woman show and became a one-woman show talking about her life. And she's very funny. She's very theatrical. And she had a career after that.
Great.
coming out of the film.
Yeah.
I'm
really curious that our show is produced mostly by a collective of transgender and non-binary people. So I'm really curious about the one transgender character who was in the film. Do you know what became of them?
Yes, of course. Teddy died of AIDS. Teddy was a wonderful person. I mean, you know, we loved our people. I have to say,
yeah.
We loved the people. I loved Teddy. He was just so authentic and so
so beautiful.
You know, so beautiful. Uh-huh. He was very bookish. He was a very bookish man. A very bookish person, I should say. And he worked in a bookstore in San Francisco for that's what he did. And as I say, he died of AIDS before Peter, probably in the early 90s. I'm not sure. It's interesting because, of course, you know, the film was made almost 50 years ago, as you say, 47 years ago. And the whole notion of transgender, the whole phenomenon of non-binary was, of course, not as developed as it is now, not as prominent, not as open, not as out, not as just, you know, 50 years makes a difference, 47 years makes a difference. Teddy was utterly comfortable being who he was. He was, I think, in a sense, the most forward-looking, the most radical, if I can use that word, in our film. And what was your feeling about him in the film?
Oh, Teddy was great. I mean, I was just fantastic. I mean, I was hoping that they were still alive because I would love to interview them next.
Yeah,
it was just such a sweet character. I mean, just so authentic, so relatable, just was very comfortable in their body and, you know, really comfortable in film talking about their life. It was, he was a great role model, you know, definitely a great role model. So yeah, I really appreciated it.
That's great. May I ask you, Emma, how did you happen to see the film? What caused you to finally see Word Is Out?
So I heard about it. There was like some story on public radio a couple of years ago. It was like they kind of revisited the original broadcast of it on KQED or something like that.
Right.
And I heard a little blip about it, so I wrote it down. I've just got a list of movies to look up sometime. And then I just recently had facial feminization surgery, and so I was out of commission for 6 weeks, and so I had a lot of time to watch movies. And so I thought, Word Is Out, I need to find that. And I found it on Canopy, and it just completely blew my mind. I mean, I was like, a kid in a candy shop. I mean, it was so great. And I see a lot of queer cinema. I mean, I've seen a lot of queer cinema. I mean, I produce radio and I watch movies and TV, and I've seen a lot, but this was great. I mean, this was so good. And it was how you produced it. I mean, it was the values that you put into it in terms of the craft, and how you chose to center people's voices that just made it so eminently relatable. And I, you know, there's not a lot of media that's been produced from 47 years ago that stands that test of time. But I think this is something that, you know, 47 years from now will be very relatable still.
Oh, well, gee, this is just so, so lovely of you to say all that. It's really, really touching. I always so regret that Peter is not around to hear that, and Nancy died as well. So,
yeah.
Anyway, it's just lovely to hear that. And you know, when we came out with the film 30 years later, and we had a DVD and the update, I have to say that the reviews that it did get as a DVD and as, you know, in the they all spoke of it's really standing the test of time. It was just a wonderful, wonderful experience for all of us. And of course, it was pre-AIDS, and it was a completely, you know, such an open spirit at the time, optimism and purposeful. It was a very purposeful film.
Yeah. I watched that, and then I watched, and then after I watched Word Is Out, then I watched And the Band Played On, because I could see the link between the two right away.
Wow. I haven't seen that film. Is it a documentary? Yeah. I mean, I know the book.
No, it was, it was a Hollywood production. It was done in, I can't remember when, in the like mid 90s they made the film. It was just an A-list of celebrities in the film, and it was, they covered like 1978 to about 1986 or 87. And they followed like a whole bunch of different people's lives in The Band Playing Down, but it was really centered, like the story was centered around the CDC and the people who were kind of doing case studies and getting together, like gathering all of the medical data that they needed for the CDC to really, so they followed like the evolution of the name of AIDS as it changed its name from like GRID, and there was something before GRID, and it eventually became AIDS. And they covered like so many different stories. A lot of it was set in the bathhouses of San Francisco. They spent a lot of time there. They really did a great job in The Band Played On of showing what the bathhouse culture meant to a queer man living in San Francisco at the time, you know? But it was just, that was kind of a good follow-up to me after seeing Word Is Out, because Word Is Out is just so optimistic. You know, it's really just a very optimistic film. And The Band Played On is also optimistic in its own kind of way, because it's kind of a story of survival. So
did you, by the way, one film that of course I mentioned is The Times of Harvey Milk. Have you seen that one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good one. That's Rob's film, Rob Epstein's film.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, The Times of Harvey Milk is Rob Epstein's film, and he won an Oscar for it, too.
Right.
It is not the, it's not the the feature film. It's not the feature film that came afterward, is it called Harvey Milk? I don't remember the name of it. But
yeah,
it's
the one with, right, yeah.
Right, the one with Franco. I think is that who played him? I can't remember. Anyway, I highly recommend The Times of Harvey Milk, the documentary of Rob Epstein, with a wonderful editor, beautiful editor named Deborah Hoffman. Just did a great job. I have to praise editors. I'm an editor myself.
Yeah, are you still active? We're getting kind of to wrap up time here, but I just wanted
Yes,
to
it is. It is.
check in with you. Are you still actively producing film?
I am still actively working on film. Yes, I'm working on a film about literary translators into English, the new crop of immigrant translators who come from various countries, but who live in America now and are translating literature from their cultures into English. And that's what I'm working on with my dear friend and colleague, Sharon Wood. And it's very hard to find funding for this subject. I will say that. It's very literary and text oriented. But in any case, I'm still working.
Great. Well, Veronica, if people would like to find out more about you, would you like to share any information if they want to look up
Oh, well,
your biography, your filmography, or anything?
I don't even have a website. I
Okay,
just don't.
we're
But
sorry about that. But if
my email, if you want my email, because I can tell you more about the film. Four of us are still very close and love the film and love talking about it. My email is the first four letters of my name, Vero. My last name is Selver, veroselver at gmail.com. And I can then put you in touch with the other filmmakers if you would like. And Emma, thank you so much. So delightful talking with you and hearing your wonderful praise of the film.
Thank you. Thanks so much. We've been talking today with Veronica Selver, who is one of the filmmakers behind the 1977 film Word Is Out, which you can still find. You can find it on Canopy. And there's, I'm not sure where else to, but you can probably buy it on Amazon. Anyways, Veronica, thank you so much for your time. It's really been a pleasure talking with you today on Transpositive.
I thank you. Bedroom surprise.